3, we can move something.
Okay. Welcome, everybody, to the April 8th, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. We got a full agenda here today. We're going to start out with a very quick one when one of the people has to leave quickly, so I'm going to do Senate 548 out of order, and then we're going to do informational meetings with for Transit Day and the Oregon Metropolitan Planning Organization Consortium. That's a mouthful.
I thought you were doing 583.
So we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 583. We have done a public hearing on this.
Right? We have.
So, James?
Chair, committee members, we've heard Senate Bill 583 a few times. It is an ominous bill dealing with the OLCC in Oregon Spirits Board and distillery portions, and also deals with brewery public houses. We have a Dash 6 amendment. The Dash 6 amendment eliminates references to cider with brewery public house license in Section 1, allows a brewery public house license to hold directly or indirectly an interest in an off-premise sales license without additional conditions, deletes Section 2 dealing with cider and brewery public license, deletes Oregon Spirits Board and distillery portions of the bill, maintains the emergency clause. It has a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Colleagues, I remind you that 583 is a result, or one of the results, of our interim committee work on dealing with OLCC and modernizing it, so it's a pretty vanilla bill. With that, the chair moves the Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 583. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, is there any opposition to the motion? Dash 6 is adopted. Chair moves Senate Bill 583 as amended to the as amended by the Dash 6 amendments to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Senate Bill 586, as amended by the Dash 6, is moved to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation.
Would you like to hear?
583, as amended by the Dash 6. Get the numbers all right. Would you like to carry
sure.
one, too?
Yeah.
Senator Rod would like to carry that. So we'll close the work session on that, and we've opened an informational meeting. Is there any introduction to that?
We have an informational meeting on for Transit Day today.
Transit Day. So, do I have a sign-up list?
No.
Welcome, everybody, for Transit. I see the buttons out there. Had the chance to meet with many of you this morning, so welcome to your capital. Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Chair Byron, members. Hey, thank you for giving me and my colleagues an opportunity to share very important information with you today. Just so you know, my name is Julie Brown. I'm general manager of the Rogue Valley Transportation District down in Southern Oregon. And I've been given the honor of not only representing my district, but transit in general in the state of Oregon. So as you can see, here is a map of Oregon and all the different transit boardings by county. I know we have a small amount of time, so I have given you a packet, and I believe you've received that.
We do
and this is just information in general about transit in the state of Oregon. In there is a document that is actually, and ODOT wanted me to make sure that you understood that I pulled this information off of the website. They did not hand it to me. This information from ODOT actually was something that I was given the honor of sharing to the Governor's Transportation Vision Panel, and I felt that this would really give you a high level of overview of transit and transportation options in the state and the information on the state's level of general fund commitment. So RVTD is one of five small urban systems in the state, and we serve populations between 50,000 and 200,000. We receive operating funds directly from the Federal Transit Administration and are required to match those funds 50% using a local match. All small urbans face that problem, and although we receive our funds directly from FTA, we are just like a large urban system that is required to comply with federal regulation, and we have to meet our safety, security, and financial, et cetera. Our second challenge is that we are faced with serving communities that are a mix of high density but mostly rural. And so we have a tough time talking about or helping small urban properties provide the level of service needed that meets not only an urban situation like in Rogue Valley in the Medford area, but also a rural area like Jacksonville. There are 34 small rural systems that serve populations of 50,000 or less in the state. They receive funds that are distributed through the state of Oregon or ODOT. And although they don't have a direct, they're not direct recipients of federal funds, they're still under the same obligations as TriMet or Lane Transit District. They still have to comply with all the safety regulations, the drug and alcohol regulations, et cetera. Although the state is the one that monitors them versus the federal government, they still, again, have all these regulations. I presented to you the picture of federal funding in order to point out the importance of state funding and how it impacts our funding streams. Oregon provides funding for elderly and disabled transportation through a couple revenue streams. One is the cigarette tax, the lawnmower fund, and the sale of Oregon ID. Now, if you think about that, that's not a lot of funding streams, but those are the funds that we receive that we're able to match our federal funding with. Again, these are distributed through ODOT, and we thank the legislators for actually doing supplemental amounts last year or this last session. And in the packet, you'll see that the amount of money that was given through the STF process to these smaller rural areas. So I've just talked about this funding is given to 36 counties, including 9 recognized tribes. All of these funds, again, are used as match to our federal funding. Last year, the legislature added $10.6 million of general fund to supplement the $15.2 that we already received. With that, there is actually a document in that folder that talks about how those funds were used. And I want to kind of talk about that just briefly. 42 of the STF agencies have reported the following information. 8 of the 125 providers were able to use the funds to match vehicle replacement grants. Those come at a match of about 10.27. All of the 42 agencies and their 125 providers will use the funds to sustain and restore operation to formal levels. What we've seen is transit, because there is no stable funding source, is constantly adding and subtracting service. So we see this dips of high and lows depending on what funding comes through. Approximately one-third of the entities that receive that funding will use a portion of those funds to match federal funds. The ability to collect the funds and use them for leverage allows systems to somewhat stabilize our funding and bring back service to prior levels when we've had to cut. All of these things add access, availability, connectivity, and economic development to our counties. So it's very important when we do receive this funding. In closing, I cannot stress how important transportation and public transit and other options are to any community. In reality, this hits home for RVTD. We just did a 25% cut. In April of 2011, we were awarded a 3-year congestion mitigation air quality grant. We were able to put in Saturday service along with evening service. When I say evening service, service that went beyond 7 p.m. but ended by 9:30 in the evening. Because this was a 3-year grant, we had to find stable funding. We went to the voters in November and asked for a ballot serial levy on our property taxes, which is how we fund our local match. It was turned down, and it was very unfortunate. But one of the things that we realized was, at the time, people received their tax bills the same time they also received their ballots. And we had just passed a 61-cent library levy in May, and they got their first bill. So with that, although the polling showed that RVT would be successful, we weren't. So we had to do a 25% cut. Transit funding is the key missing ingredient in transit agencies to meet rising ridership and operating demands. For operating support to work, the funding needs to be reliable and sustainable so that agencies can add service without the danger of being forced to cut when the funding diminishes. In short, operating support provides a reliable transportation network that gets people to jobs, medical, and social opportunities. The end result is better livability for Oregonians by reducing congestion, improving the air quality, which is really important for our area, and meeting the local social and economic needs. I believe the time is right and that you as a committee are faced with hard decisions. Please know that we are passionate about this issue. All of us sitting here at the table and in this room are here to help you and be a resource to you, and please feel free to call upon us at any time. I'm going to turn this over to TriMet and to LTD to talk about their systems, but wait, I just wanted to give you a brief. This is what we're facing, all the rest of us. You know, we need some help.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Girard, Senator Monroe, my name is Neil McFarland. I'm TriMet's General Manager, and I appreciate the opportunity to offer some testimony about where TriMet is as a transit provider. Again, we serve 25 cities in Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas counties with a combined population of about 1.5 million people. We provide that service through bus, light rail, commuter rail, and our Lyft paratransit system. We're also partners with the City of Portland in operating the Portland streetcar. When I talk about TriMet, I often like to talk about the four roles that we often provide in our community. First is getting employees to work and customers to their opportunities, to stores. You should know that TriMet provides about 100 million rides a year. And 45% of the rush hour commuters to downtown Portland use the TriMet service that we provide. Our second role I often talk about is easing congestion. And again, TriMet has, I think, been quite successful in this role. You might know that TriMet is actually number 9 in the nation in per capita ridership, even though we're about the 24th largest metropolitan area. We also carry on our MAX system 1 in 3 commuters on the Banfield or the Sunset Highway corridors. And while there's no complete suggestion answer to congestion other than a depression, TriMet is a cost-effective way to shave the peak off the congestion demand. Our third and very important role is to provide literally millions of rides to seniors and people with disabilities, school kids, youngsters, those who can't afford a car and don't have any other alternative but TriMet. And TriMet allows these people to be full members of our community. Providing this mobility isn't always inexpensive. It isn't always the most efficient service we provide, but it's a critical service, and it's every bit as important as education and healthcare because it's how people actually access those vital services. Our fourth role is to help our region manage growth. And I'll talk a little bit more about some of the current efforts we have underway about that. But clearly, TriMet system has provided a framework for our growing communities and managing the effects of sprawl and pollution. We do face in our business a number of challenges, and I'm proud to say that coming out of the Great Recession, TriMet is in a much stronger place than where we had been historically. We, like all businesses, need to make very difficult decisions about our cost structure at various points in time. And we have taken steps over the last few years to realign employee benefits to reflect fiscal reality. And we've achieved a fair and balanced change in our labor contract that has cut long-term liabilities substantially. We regularly reevaluate our business practices and our services. And for that, we are, at this point in time, sustainable. And with this structural cost reform and a continued growth now in our region, we are making some really key strategic investments. By the end of this year, we'll actually have restored all of our frequent service routes to 15-minute frequencies. Those are the 12 major bus routes that serve a great deal of our demand, as well as our MAX system frequencies restored. We've stepped up our capital investment in our bus replacements and in actually beginning to repair and replace some of our 30-year-old infrastructure for the first light rail line, what we call the state of good repair, and a number of safety improvements as well. So we've worked hard to position ourselves so that we can address the growth demands of our region. We're told that within the next 20 years, we'll grow by the equivalent of 4 new Hillsboroughs. That's expected also to come along with 260,000 jobs in the region. The Portland Business Alliance's cost of congestion study shows us that we can expect a 50% increase in car trips and a 75% increase in truck trips. investing in transit and roads reduces this congestion. And their study shows that actually we can do a significant job of reducing that congestion with investment as called for in our regional transportation plan. And TriMet is a key part of that solution, but it's a balanced solution that's required with roads and transit. I just wanted to also note we have some very exciting projects and enhancements of our system upcoming. First of all is the Orange Line, the Portland and Milwaukee project, will be opening September 12th on time and actually under budget, which is something we're very proud to be able to say. As of March 2015, that project has also contributed more than 13,000 jobs to our regional economy. 547 firms have participated in construction. Nearly 80% of those are based in Oregon. $174 million of revenue to 131 different disadvantaged business enterprises as well. And I wanted to mention that because your investment as the Oregon legislature from the Oregon Lottery of $250 million was really fundamental to making that project a reality, and I wanted to thank you once again for that action. We are also working with our communities on the future of transit, and we have a broad effort underway in our region to look at the future of transit in each major segment of our region and to plan with all of our employers, our stakeholders, our cities and counties, the best way to reformat and enhance our transit service over a period of time. Our model for that was what we called our West Side Service Enhancement Plan, which was worked with employers on the West Side, which, as you know, includes some of Oregon's largest employers and largest companies, and actually created a vision that can serve their needs well into the future. We also have underway two new corridor studies, actually led by our Metro Planning Organization, Metro, the Powell Division Corridor, which currently is one of our larger ridership corridors. And many people don't realize that between our division bus and our Powell bus, we actually carry 18,000 rides a day in that corridor. And we're looking for ways to improve that ridership and improve the ridership experience through a bus rapid transit project. We're also working with Metro on the Southwest Corridor, which is the broad segment of the region that really follows I-5 South and 99W to Tigard and Tualatin through Southwest Portland, and looking at both light rail and bus as well as other alternatives and investments needed to make improve mobility in that corridor. So with that, it's a very quick update. I wanted to thank you again for your time, and as your time permits, be happy to answer questions you may have.
Chair Beyer and members of the committee, my name is Ron Kilcoyne, and I'm the general manager of Lane Transit District serving the Eugene-Springfield metropolitan area. LTD started in 1970 as one of the only two statutorily created transit agencies in the state, TriMet being the other. LTD grew from 18 buses serving 13 routes to that time to more than 100 buses serving 36 routes throughout most of urbanized Lane County. And we have done so while only raising our tax rate once, but we do have an authorization to increase another 0.1%. Our regular fixed route and MX bus rapid transit provide 11.5 million rides per year. Our buses drive more than 3.5 million miles per year, which is equivalent of 140 trips around the earth. We provide service to 23 communities, ranging from Cottage Grove in the south to Junction City in the north, Veneta in the west, up along the McKenzie River to the McKenzie River Ranger Station. In 2014, we were recognized by the American Public Transportation Association as the best mid-sized transit system in the United States. In addition to the fixed route service, we provide nearly 80,000 paratransit rides to elderly and people with disabilities, and our RideSource call center brokers an additional 200,000 annual rides for individuals on the Oregon Health Plan and about 16 other social service programs. I mentioned we have 36 routes. They include 5 rural routes as well as our 2 MX BRT routes. Now, Eugene-Springfield is number 19 in per capita ridership. As Neil mentioned, TriMet's number 9. So that means 2 of the top 20 regions for per capita transit ridership in the United States are here in the state of Oregon. Also, as far as productivity as and per capita ridership is, of course, the boardings per the population of our service area. But in terms of productivity, boardings for each hour of service, we're number 22 in the nation of all the transit systems that report to federal receive federal funds. Our MX bus rapid transit system provides fast and efficient service between Eugene and Springfield. It has its own dedicated lanes. It also shares lanes with turning traffic, and it can run in mixed traffic. So it is a very flexible mode that can operate in a number of different environments depending on the local situation. Service is every 10 minutes, and the stops are about every third mile. And each of the stops are really stations. They're iconic stations that people can identify, know where to catch the bus, and they allow for level boarding and off-board fare collection, which provides really speeds up the service. The first line opened in 2007, second in 2010, and the next line, which is under construction, is in West Eugene, is scheduled to open in the fall of 2017. And our MXBRT line accounts for 25% of the annual boardings on the system. Now, I'd like to focus on two of the primary benefits of transit, and transit provides quite a few number of benefits, but I'm going to just focus, because of the limited time, I'm just going to focus on two. One is how we help people succeed, and two, how we help grow the economy. For many who do not live in the Eugene-Springfield area, the only experience they have with LTD is our football shuttle buses, which transport nearly 10,000 fans per home game to Autzen Stadium. But in reality, we do a lot more. Driving is expensive and time-consuming, and quality transit allows people to choose to save money and ride in a different way. And for a lot of students stuck with a lot of college debt, they find that, well, if they have to pay off the college loans, they don't want to have a car loan on top of it, and transit is a way for getting them around. In the Eugene-Springfield area, a majority of our riders are choice riders, meaning that they had access to a vehicle but chose to ride the bus. This is possible because 92% of the households in the metro area are within a half mile of bus stops. For students, and I already made this reference, but we do help make college more affordable, and we save our college's public money. We serve both the University of Oregon and Wayne Community College, and half of LTD riders are students. And as an example of how we help the college, 30,000 people are on the University of Oregon campus on any given day, but only 3,000 parking spots exist. Building new garages would cost millions and waste valuable limited real estate. We also allow seniors to remain independent. Our RideSource paratransit offers 80,000 rides to seniors and persons with disabilities who are unable to use our fixed route service. Demand for RideSource has increased 100% over the past 10 years and continues to grow rapidly with an aging population. It is a critical service to allow seniors to age in place, and there's been studies that show that seniors aging in place cost about one-fourth of seniors in some kind of institution or facility. Top destinations include dialysis, doctor's appointments, and grocery shopping. This is a federal unfunded mandate, and it costs roughly $6 million a year. This is subsidized through our general fund, which limits our ability to invest in service to serve the whole community, including providing service for seniors and disabled that could use fixed route service if it were available. As I mentioned earlier, the RideSource Call Center houses 17 different programs, including the Oregon Health Plan, Veterans Transportation, and 15 more. And this allows for both efficiency by consolidating, which allows cost sharing and trip sharing, which minimizes costs and maximizes efficiency, but it also improves customer service because individuals only have one place they need to call for the trip. They don't have to try to figure out where they need to call for a particular type of trip. And how do we grow the economy? Transit is an amenity that makes our region more attractive, like parks, good schools, and public safety. It is a tool to attract top talent and recruit new businesses. And an example is that we find that a lot of businesses looking to want to locate in the Eugene-Springfield area want to know how good is the transit service, and that's a key driver. And the fixed skyway like MX drives economic development because the developer knows it's going to be there for many more years to come, and they're willing to build and invest in higher density mixed-use development near stations. How are we funded? Our operating budget is $49 million. Approximately 80% of our operating budget is provided on direct service provision. Two-thirds of that comes from the employee-funded payroll tax. And this is, if there's only one thing that you remember from the three things that we said, the three of us said today, is that Oregon only provides approximately 3%. The state of Oregon provides only approximately 3% of the operating funds for transit. Nationally, the average for state support of transit is 24%. Anyway, I want to thank you for the time for listening, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions of the panel? Senator Bradley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I was late coming and may have missed this, but we have Pacific University that has campuses in both Forest Grove and Hillsboro. When are we doing the MAX line to Forest Grove?
I think, again, Neil McFarland, I think I'll take that on, which is that actually we are looking at some pretty innovative services in Forest Grove. As you know, we've established something, a service called GroveLink, which has been very popular and very effective, which is essentially a shuttle service that serves a low-density area but connects those low-density areas to the lifeline of the Line 57 frequent service line that serves the two universities you noted. There is a railroad right-of-way.
I know.
In that vicinity, and we are in constant communication about that. But I would tell you that the regional transportation plan has it identified as a high capacity corridor, but it's not a high priority. One of the things that we are interested in doing in the next beginning, 5 to 10 years is really beginning to study a BRT on Tualatin Valley Highway, really between Beaverton and ultimately Forest Grove. And that might involve that right-of-way as well. But that would be in the future.
Follow-up. When TriMet came and talked to me about the east side rail, one of the things I was told is, Forest Grove is next. And so I went along, and I absolutely agreed to support that east side line. I think it's time for you to step up.
We were able to stretch that line, I remember doing this from Beaverton to Hillsboro. And we've had a very, I think, organized process led by Metro in our region to actually look at these lines and investments and corridors one by one. And by doing that, you're right, that we have been able to actually stretch our investments and secure, I think the total now is about $2.2 billion of discretionary federal dollars brought into our region to help our economy and help our transportation system. So, message received.
Senator Monroe?
Yeah, Neil, is there any move as you convert your fleet of buses to go to cleaner fuels like propane, natural gas, or electricity?
So we don't have a plan in place right now for that, but I would tell you that we are evaluating really on an annual basis. The conversion to compressed natural gas, I think, would be the next cycle. We've also applied, but I've been unsuccessful in securing federal grants that would help us do some experiments in that regard, or in, frankly, related to electric technology, which is, I think, where our industry will go ultimately. But again, there's a lot of growth of technology that's going to be required before we get there, but we'd love to be part of that.
Thank you.
Anything else? Well, thank you very much. Very informative. We appreciate you taking the time to come down today. We do have a few minutes. I got a full agenda. If there are a few people who would like to comment on transit. We didn't have a sign-up sheet out for it. Is there anybody?
I'll make a comment. This is Art Stevenson. I live here in Salem, and we need
Salem in here too, doing some very innovative things to create a better transit system for the elderly and people with disabilities. It's desperately needed here in the capital city.
Thank you, Art.
If I have epilepsy and
Could I get you to come up to the microphone, please? For the, we've got to get it on the record.
Did I get on the record?
You had a good voice, Art. So I think it probably caught it.
My name is Amy Kelly. I have epilepsy, so I don't drive. And this has been a thing since I was an infant. I grew up south of Cottage Grove, and about 13 miles south. My parents about half a mile down Logging Road. And I moved to Portland just basically for TriMet. If I did not have a good transit system available, I would basically be stuck. I couldn't go to the store, couldn't go to my medical appointments, couldn't go see family, see my friends. Basically, having a transit system that is accessible and comprehensive means that I can do all the things that adults get to do and not have to rely on having other people driving places. I get to be independent because I have the ability to just take a bus somewhere.
Great. Thank you very much. Anybody else? Okay, and we'll move on to the next group, the Oregon Metropolitan Planning Organization Committee. And I see one of my mayors out there. Thank you all for coming today from Transit. Now this is a group I didn't know existed.
That's why we're here.
We suspected that might be the case.
Are we ready? So, Chair Beyer and members of the committee, I'm Christine Lundberg. I'm the mayor of Springfield, and I'm here today representing the Central Lane MPO. Thank you for providing time for us today. We appreciate it very much, and I know that it took a little bit of I know that you're very busy this week, so we very much appreciate that you've taken this time. We have a short presentation on the Oregon Metropolitan Planning Organization Commission, or OMPOC, where I currently serve as the chair. So within the packets, there were packets that we provided for you, and within that you're going to see who makes up OMPOC. We are a partnership throughout the state, and I'm going to point out just two handouts. One is Oregon MPO Quick Facts, which shows you, it's a green sheet, it shows you who the eight MPOs are, and also there's another handout, it's two pages, and it shows you who is on the boards, and I'm guessing most of you will recognize someone that's within those boards. There are eight MPOs in the state. They are located in regions where the population is 50,000 or more. And you can see we have a map that shows you where all of the MPOs are located throughout the state. The MPOs are driven by local jurisdiction processes. So you start out at the city levels and the county, and then those, all of the decisions that are made there are then brought to the MPOs. The MPOs are made up of all of those jurisdictions that participate, along with ODOT. ODOT is a sitting member on the MPO, MPO, and decisions about priorities are made at that MPO level. MPOs are important because they are the federally designated organizations that allow us to receive federal funding and be able to actually allocate planning dollars out to be able to address our transportation needs. Two-thirds of the population are located within the MPOs in the state, and a million of those people live outside of the Portland area. And they make up 11 of the counties and 50 of the cities within the state. And the most important thing I think I want to say is within those MPOs, although there are other areas that aren't within the MPOs represent the areas that in many cases provide employment. They provide hospital services. They provide banking service. They provide some of the services that the outlying areas need to utilize. And so even though they're within a set boundaries, they also represent a lot of the people that within their own jurisdictions don't necessarily have all the services they need. But we are a very strong partnership, and the fact that we can all get together and agree on transportation priorities, I think, is a great opportunity for us to be able to move a lot of things forward here at this table also. So thank you very much, and I'm going to turn it over.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of this committee. My name is Mark Gatlin. I am a city councilor for the city of Grants Pass, a member of the Middle Rogue MPO, and as a first-time presenter to this Capitol and this committee, of course, I've been gifted with the bad news portion of today's presentation. Oregon's MPOs are transportation and economic hubs for our state's economy. As such, the MPOs are growing rapidly, straining our statewide transportation system. This increased demand is a demand for better transit in bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure as well. And the demands for this new infrastructure are outpacing our ability to meet our ability to expand facilities. One critical indicator are the commercial truck trips. Truck trips could take as much as 30% longer by 2030. The impact of this increase could mean the average truck could make three fewer deliveries per day. A decrease in travel time, reliability, how long a trip might take on a given day, is expected to accompany the overall delay. This would cause a need for overtime, relief drivers, possibly more trucks on the road, and in the worst case scenario, businesses moving out of our region, exacerbating the sluggish growth of our economy. Maintenance costs are rapidly consuming capital budgets. Inflation and fuel efficiency is undermining the purchasing power of the gas revenue. As you're aware, as our cars and trucks get better on the road, they're using less fuel. Neighboring states are turning to sales tax to augment transportation budgets, an option not available here in Oregon. Transit partners work tirelessly to bring back federal dollars into Oregon, but literally hundreds of thousands of dollars are left on the table because of the mandated 50% requirement for matching funds. Partnerships to exploit every dollar available are made by the MPOs and their transit partners. A great example is Lane Transit District donating two buses to our local Josephine County Transit District for a new route connecting riders from Grants Pass to Medford that actually stretches the line from Cave Junction to White City, taking care of our veterans who need to make hospital appointments there in White City, and the entire Rogue Valley Transit District line. I'll pass this on to my partner here.
Thank you very much, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. Good to be here this afternoon. Thank you for making time for us in your busy schedule. My name is Craig Dirksen. I'm Metro Councilor, and I am the chair of the Portland MPO. I would like to just say that on top of the challenges we see, we bring solutions. That is our goal as MPOs. MPOs, we're the ones making the land use and the transportation connection. We're the ones who are working to create a more balanced transportation system. And it's our investments in our urban areas that are really leveraging Oregon's economic development and economic health. We also provide leadership not only in growth, but as well as that, we deal with greenhouse gas reductions. We're meeting the state targets for greenhouse gas emissions, and we also factor public health into our investment decisions. MPOs are making near-term investments over $200 million in our eight MPOs in local, regional, and federal funds over the next 4 years. Those local facilities continue to serve as a growing share of the statewide travel. In our 20-year plan, $18 billion of investment are planned in the MPOs, which will help Oregon compete with the world, the nation, and our West Coast neighbors, California and Washington. We maintain and improve our road and highway system, but we're also working, as I said, to make a broader and more balanced transportation system. We're investing in rural roads that have to be brought up to urban standards. We're working to expand transit services, as you heard from the previous presenters. We're building sidewalk and bike retrofits, safety improvements, improving traveler information services, investing in intelligent transportation system management technology, which leverages the existing facilities we have and make them more reliable, safe, and efficient in travel. Also, we're investing in traditional main streets and downtown districts, helping to revitalize those. Through our efforts, commercial strips and corridors are being revitalized, and we are developing in each of our MPOs regional bike and ped networks. To accomplish all these things, we need your help. We need the state of Oregon to be our partner and help us invest and fund these challenges, to fund the improvements that we need across the state. Towards that end, we support the concepts behind the Oregon Transportation Forum's funding principles of needing to increase the gas tax to address both maintenance and system expansion, increases to the gas tax to catch up with where we need to be because we're behind the curve, and then index that gas tax to fuel economy to keep pace with inflation, to keep up. We need an increase to catch up and an index to keep up. In addition, we would ask you to expand the state role in transit, as was requested by the earlier presenters as well, by helping cover the cost of elderly and disabled service. Typical transit service, a ride costs a transit agency about $2, but a call for elderly or disabled service as required by the federal mandate is about $30 per ride. It's a huge burden on local transit service providers, and it prevents them from being able to improve general transit for the entire population. It's much a social service as it is a transportation service, and we would request the state to consider to step up and become more of a partner in that. In addition, we would ask that the legislature restore Connect Oregon to its original $100 million per year funding level, as well as make it a dedicated annual funding source. We know that working all together, we can make these things happen. We can do the investments we need to do to create the Oregon transportation, complete Oregon transportation system that will carry our economy into the future. We appreciate your listening, and we ask for your help. And we'll be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Just noticing the first two, we seem to have a conflict of constitutional values there. Senator Monroe.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Craig.
Afternoon. Good to see you.
Currently, yeah, I have a cold. Currently, the elderly and handicapped transportation gets 2 cents on a pack of cigarettes dedicated to that. Would you support increasing that amount, say, by a nickel?
I hadn't considered what a funding source might be, but it would certainly be something that would be worthy of consideration, sure.
Well, it's a current funding source, and so it's easier sometimes to increase a current source than to find a whole new one, plus the fact that our tobacco taxes are more than a dollar a pack lower than the state of Washington.
Good point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Girard?
Yes, I chair the Capital Construction Committee, and Connect Oregon money goes through that usually. And I just have to tell you, we can't dedicate an annual source. We can't oblige future legislators to fund a certain source. So I'm not trying to rain on your parade, but that part's out. But everything else, I think almost everybody knows that we need to improve transportation dramatically. And I'm a rural legislator, and I haven't heard anybody talk about running a rail line to Idana, but I do know that we need that in the urban centers, and I think we're mostly very aware of the problem.
Senator Riley?
Thank you very much. So the previous panel said that the corridor to between Hillsborough and Forest Grove is a high traffic area, but not a high priority. And I'm noticing that on the Portland Metro MPO, there's no one from Hillsborough or Forest Grove on that, although they are in Metro. And that may be one of the reasons it's a low priority.
Well, Senator, I would hope not. We look for at the Metro, at the JPAC table, and in Metro, we look for regional solutions and look at the region as a whole. But with due respect to the center, I would point out that we do have an entire quadrant of the Portland Metro area that has no high-capacity transit at present, and it is on the list for the next step, for the next extension. We look forward to the future when we'll be able to access all those other areas as well. I've always been a proponent of a complete transportation system that both in the Portland metro area and statewide, we need a complete transportation system that includes all the modes in the correct proportion so that they support one another. And we need a complete network of transit in order to make any part of the transit system actually work at its highest efficiencies.
One more shot.
Go ahead.
Your second one about indexing the gas tax to fuel economy. This would be another suggestion I would have. I think you should do it. We should do it through registration fees. I just think that's a lot easier than having different rates at the fuel pump. So, otherwise you're going to have the fuel, the people that are actually using the gas paying a lot more. Whereas if you did it through registration fees, electric cars and hybrids could be, we could have a sliding scale in that direction. So that's another suggestion.
I appreciate that, and that was discussed. And I think we acknowledge up front, and the forum did as well, that they would recognize any increase to gas taxes or indexing of gas taxes as being an interim step until we can change and move to a vehicle mileage fee base here in Oregon to replace the gas tax so that the burden doesn't fall only on those vehicles that use gasoline as a fuel source.
So can I just add that one of the important pieces of OMPOC is we do represent a pretty significant part of the population, and we are always willing to look at a lot of different options in terms of how we go about making sure that we have transportation funding. And the fact that we can agree, even though we are all the way from a large metro area down to some smaller areas within the state, we still have been able to come together, and we're willing, of course, to work hard. And if there are other options that we might take up as OMPOC, we certainly would be willing to take a look at them and be able to, through our network, be able to advocate for some things.
One more.
Go ahead.
I'm on a roll right now.
Yes, you are.
Yeah. Again, I represent a rural area, so mileage tax, I'm just telling you, it's not going to be popular out where we are. To me, it's really making it easier for the cities and harder on the rural areas. I drive 35 miles to work, and so I really think that you should concentrate, if you want to have both sides of the aisle, on registration fees, because that's where the discrepancy can easily be addressed, and you're not disadvantaging one group over another. That's my opinion.
That is an opinion.
No, that is an opinion. I've been known to have one or two.
Actually, I sit, as well as Senator Monroe does, on the task force for vehicle mileage fee, and we would be happy to share some information we have with you of studies we've done about relative commutes for urban areas and rural areas.
Well, if the fees were discriminatory, so that if you drove I-5 during rush hour, you're going to pay top dollar, and in the urban centers, you're going to pay a higher level because that's where the congestion is. Then you might be able to buy off. My district, let me give you an example. I sent out birthday cards, and people got upset because I had the information when their birthday was. You want to go in, and you want them to furnish where they've been in their cars. It's not going to fly in my district. I'm just telling you.
Along with the birthday telephone number.
Along with that one. Along with my telephone number.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much for sharing this with us. Is there others who wanted to speak on this?
No.
I do not
no,
know.
I don't think. I don't no, think we're so. Getting yeah. we're getting no's yeah. from Great. The people that actually.
Thank
know.
You for
thank
giving
you.
Us
We've
the time.
We've been doing a lot of discussion around transportation, so appreciate
yes.
your being
yes.
here.
Yes, and we appreciate your work very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so with nothing else, we will then move on to a couple of bills we've got. I think I'm going to. Let's see. I've got a toss-up of legislators back there.
Yeah, you got
all
at
right.
least three or four.
So let's see. Let's do 548 we've heard before. So we'll do that real quick. So we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 548. Do we have amendments?
We do.
But we don't want them.
So well. Senate Bill 548 authorizes county to sell or donate property to eligible Indian tribes in Oregon, declares emergency effective on passage. There is no revenue impact or no fiscal impact with that. We also have a -2 amendment, provides eligible tribe the right of first refusal to purchase property that is located within the boundaries of their existing or former reservation. There is no revenue or nor fiscal impact with that either.
And Senator Johnson, do you want to address this and bring your commissioner with you? You've heard this one before? We were hopeful that you all would go off and come up with a kumbaya solution, did you?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Betsy Johnson, Senate District 16, we worked like hell on Kumbaya, and we fell just a tiny bit short, but I still think we have a great bill supported by the majority of the tribes, and I'm just here to lend my support to a good bill and ask Commissioner Labhart to fill in some of the details.
So to be clear, Senator, are you advocating for the bill as introduced or with one or more of the amendments?
I'm advocating for the bill as introduced.
Senator Beyer, members, my name is Mark Labhart. You've heard from me before. I'm actually from Tillamook County, but today I'm representing not only Tillamook County, but again, the Association of Oregon Counties. I think I said this before, clearly all 36 counties in Oregon support this bill as is. The -2 amendments, it's a separate issue. It is not germane to the bill at all. We strongly support and ask that you move the bill as is. It's fairly straightforward. It just adds tribes, as it would any other state or federal agency, the ability to exchange, sell, or trade land. So that's essentially what it is. It's fairly straightforward. We strongly ask you to support the bill as it is.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you very much, both. There's no one signed up in opposition, but in a sense of fairness, is there anybody who wishes to speak in opposition to this bill? Seeing none, we are in work session, so the chair would move Senate Bill 548 as amendment to the floor. Or is there a subsequent?
There's no subsequent.
To the floor, but they do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? That was a yes. That wasn't a no. Okay. Just being clear, Senator. Senate Bill 548 is moved to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation.
Of Johnson carry.
Huh?
Position is like this.
Senator Johnson wants to carry the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll close on Senate Bill 548. We'll open a. Do we need a public hearing on 941?
934, yes.
We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 934. Senator Roblin.
Do you want me to read it?
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 934, places limitation on state liability for non-property claims applicable to the State Fair Council, exempts council from certain statutory provisions regarding the State Commission for the Blind, increases number of available seats in the council from 7 to 11 to 9 to 13, provides for the appointment of additional members of the Legislative Assembly to be non-voting observer and advisor to council. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact and no amendments.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So I will start, and then I'll let other people fill in, and I'll give a brief explanation of why we're here today. As you know, a couple years ago, we made the decision to try to make the State Fair a quasi-governmental agency for the purpose of getting the fair in the black. Our fair has cost money pretty much since its inception to the state, and we had moved it to the state parks, and they were saying this is costing us a lot of money. We can't really do a lot of the things that would help us make money. And so we came up with this new plan to form the board, and what we have come to understand is there is a couple things that other quasi state agencies do that we would like to partake of as well, because we think the purpose of forming this new State Fair Council was for us to see how we could manage it to make enough money to break even. We don't need to make a lot of money, but we want to be able to repair the buildings and fix the State Fair grounds and start using it year-round in a lot more, therefore do advertising and so on. As we went through the statutes, we came up with three areas that we wanted to have a conversation and put into a bill, and they are as follows. The first section has to do with liability, and we looked around and recognized that the only other agency that's or any other state quasi-organization that's out there, if you really look at it, we don't think we're yet the OHSU, but OHSU is at one of those agencies where we said, go forth and do your work, and we aren't going to be able to give you as much money as you need, so be entrepreneurial. We see the State Fair as the same thing, and so the first one is the liability, and we want to make sure that we believe, and we've talked to our attorneys, that we are covered, but it's not explicit. So in this bill, it just makes that explicit that we can use the same kind of liability insurance. Number two, there is a state statute that allows for the Commission of the Blind to be the first vendor to come in and work in food preparation, vending machines, those kinds of things. In our plan, as we were developing it, one of the things we can do that the state couldn't do was we can get sponsors. And so we can put a sign up that says the horse area is sponsored by XYZ, this is sponsored by that, we can get that money and then use it to keep the fair going. One of the other groups that's done that traditionally in schools, which like OHSU are exempt from this particular statute with regard to the Commission of the Blind, are concerned if we wanted to get a Coke or a Pepsi or whatever as the number one vehicle for the whole deal, they give you a contract for that, they give you some extra money, and then everything there will be labeled with Coke for the period of time that you've gotten it, and it gets money for the state fair. With the way the statute's written, we believe that this particular deal would interfere with that possibility. We actually believe that there are places that we would love to work with the blind to give them an opportunity to do that. That's not our problem, but as the statute's written, we believe that it could include all of our vendors on the midway, and so we wanted to make sure that it was clarified and that people understood that we should make a place for the blind. But like schools and like OHSU, as we are, the function that we were set up for was to make this a self-sufficient organization, and we believe that this is a tool. So that's also in the bill. And the third thing, there was a little battle when the first group was formed, and when we wrote down the rules about how many people would be on the board, one of the things they put down was one legislator. And so the Senate and the Senate President and the House Speaker kind of fought over who was going to get that. And so the first person appointed was a really wonderful friend of mine who's sitting in the audience, Berger. And she came to me and said, look, I have more right to be there than you do. So we had this little cute, fun thing together. At the end of the day, the Senate President appointed one anyway. So I go, because we're non-voting as well. And so we have been kind of serving in that role since the inception, and this codifies it that one from the House and one from the Senate, along with expanding the board, because again, as many of you may know, part of the process of a board is not that they're going to be at every meeting, but that they bring resources with them, and they bring connections to other industry people that could be helpful in the fair. And getting those people on the board would be really helpful for us in, again, meeting our mission, which is to make this fair self-supporting. We have about, well, minimally $50 million worth of repairs that need to be done. We think that's, it should be higher because that didn't include any of the roofs. And as people know in Oregon, roofs are expensive and also very important to keep the asset going. Our goal is to expand the use of the fairgrounds so that's full 12 months and actually start having events out there and do more stuff, but it takes some infrastructure fix-up before that will happen. We've asked for some of that in a different bill, but in this one, it's our purpose is to raise enough resources so that we can get the fair back in shape and figure out how we're going to move forward with getting the resources necessary to annually run the fair. I think an institution we need to keep in the state, and I'm worried if we don't have some of these things done, it will make that job harder. So that's my testimony, and I thank you for listening, and I hope that I said that I'm Senator Arne Roblin from District 5. So if I hadn't, that's for the record. Okay. And
hey, Senator.
Thank Senator you, Mr. Durfler. Chair. My name is Gene Durfler. I'm chairing this committee that's making this transition. As all of you know, when you try to make a change that we have in Senate Bill 7, invariably you don't cover all the bases. So we're looking at this bill as sort of a cleanup bill to cover the things that were missed or probably incorrect when it was written and passed. I think, as Arne said, that the first item, of course, is the liability. It was understood that we would be covered under the state's liability portion, and it doesn't really make it clear in the bill, so this bill makes it clear that we are covered under the state liability policy. We have to pay for it, but it still it would help us make the fair profitable. The second item, of course, is the blind, and I agree with Arne that certainly we need to work with the blind, but the way the statute is written, they could take over the entire food vending part, and that's a big part of the fair. Frankly, we wouldn't be able to operate the fair if we have to live under that statute, so we're hoping that that we could be exempt from that. And the third item, of course, again, is, as you said, that there's some ambiguity in the number of people we can have on the council, and we just are asking for clarification on that. So those are the items that we are asking to get corrected so we can move forward.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Girard, members of the committee, as both Senator Roblin and Gene said, passage of SB 7 represents both an unprecedented opportunity and a daunting challenge, as you're well aware. The council and the new management team are enthusiastic and confident that the Oregon State Fair and Expo Center can and will thrive once again in the future. I don't have much to add to the comments that were already made. We are currently in the process of, in our startup mode, of shopping for our entire insurance package. And clearly what our liability limits are become part of that conversation very quickly, because it's not succinct in statute as to what the exposure is. With respect to, you know, the food and beverage part, our annual revenue budget this year is roughly about $5 million. Food and beverage is not only central to the event experience, not just the fair, but other events and our ability to attract other events, but it represents about 17% of our revenue. We don't believe that jeopardizing that is going to make our life or our job any easier to with the mission that we've been given. I agree that we need to find a place and a way to work with the blind, but it simply is too much a critical part of our business model to leave to chance. That's all I have to add, and try to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Girard?
Oh, I have a comment, and this I've talked to the two of the three that's up there, but this goes to the good senator. when we did away with horse racing, I have to tell you, I think that was a colossal mistake. But that's Fred Gerard's opinion, which isn't always worth a whole lot.
So as a comment, one of the fairs in the counties that I represent, and one of the few counties that I rent, about half of it, Tillamook, still has horse racing. It is an amazing event. Their county fair, I would encourage anyone in the state of Oregon to come and attend. It is a unique, all-American experience, and I would hope people would come. But
other questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Do we have an amendment? No amendments.
I'm good.
A little bit.
I'll carry it if unless Courtney wants it. I don't think he does.
I don't think so. What? So we are, let's see. Sorry, we're in work session. We're not in work session. We're in public hearing. I'm getting ahead of myself here. I have two people who wanted to speak, Art Stevenson and Randy Hulk. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Senator Beyer, Senator Gerard, fellow members of the Business and Transportation Committee. First of all, I don't know where to get. Can you kind of give me an idea on how much time I'm going to get?
Well, I would hope that you could do it in a couple of minutes.
Okay. Well, I'll try to make.
But if you
it
need more than that, we'll.
Because we just learned about this bill and the part. By the way, my name is Art Stevenson. I wear many hats. I'm an advocate for the blind. I'm also a member of the elected committee of the Business Enterprise Program, which is the Randolph Shepherd Vending Program here in the state of Oregon. I'm also a part of many advocacy organizations for the blind. We just learned about this hearing yesterday. Otherwise, there'd be more blind people here. And if this bill in its existence moves forward, I can guarantee you that there's going to be more blind people here, because the blind community is very outraged at this point in time. Number one, the new fair committee never came to us, never came to the Commission for the Blind. And we were assuming they were going to be coming to us because they promised that they would when they almost kicked us out of the fair last year. And we were looking forward to opening up a conversation and an opportunity to work with the fair the vending that we currently have. I can tell you that this idea and notion that the Commission for the Blind wants to take over all the vending stuff from the fair and take away the revenues is ridiculous. It's outrageous. And as a blind Oregonian who's been involved with fairs all my life, 50 years. I'm 59. That's when I started enjoying fairs here in the state of Oregon. But I'm really disappointed because I've lived here in Salem for 29 years, and I've watched the state fair go downhill. And it does need some attention, and I'm excited about this new committee, and I hope this time it works, because I know we've tried several things, but it isn't going to work if we don't make good business decisions and work together collaboratively and break promises and go behind the scenes and come up with legislation to kick the blind out of the state fairgrounds, kick us out of the bus, instead of working with us and making this a positive situation. And I'm really disappointed that this new board didn't even bother coming to us and talking about the issues and working with us at finding good solutions. But I can guarantee you we have no thoughts of taking over. All right now, all we're doing is the vending machines. I belong to the American Council of the Blind here in Salem, and I think this new committee can get organizations that are here and get help, and we can do a lot of creative things here at our state fair. I'm a major in, I have 2 degrees in business administration and marketing, and I want to team with this new group and work together and make the fair turn around. But kicking the blind out is not the solution. And so, as senators, I urge you to say, hey, we're not going to do this right now because you haven't worked with the blind. You haven't discussed things. We, the blind, work with Coca-Cola, and they sponsor things with the blind, the Randolph Shepherd Vending Program. We can work together and get those sponsorship dollars for the fairgrounds together. But the solution is not kicking the blind out of the fairgrounds. The solution is us all working together to resolve the problems that the state fair has had for very many years, and not letting us be a part of it is just wrong. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Byers and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Randy Hout. I'm a lifelong blind Oregon resident. I've also been a licensed blind vendor, licensed through the Oregon Commission for the Blind and the Business Enterprise Program for almost 30 years. I also serve as president of Blind Employment Services of Tomorrow, which is a membership based advocacy organization for persons who are blind here in Oregon. What I would like to share with you is that I am here in opposition to Senate Bill 934, and as Mr. Stevenson said, this bill somewhat slipped under the radar, and so we had very short notice to that. I can tell you there are persons who are blind, who are licensed blind vendors here in Oregon, who are very concerned with this. From my perspective, while I totally commend the efforts of the Fair Committee, what I will share with you is that the Business Enterprise Program in Oregon and the Randolph Shepherd Vending Stand Act nationally are the single leading most successful employment opportunities for persons who are blind, who, by the way, there's over a 70% unemployment rate of persons who are blind. So as we look at these kind of intrusions to the preference for persons who are blind, we really hold near and dear that concern. The law was enacted here in Oregon to help promote and provide employment opportunities for persons who are blind, and that's what we really believe in, and that's what we ask you to believe in. What I will share with you is there has been a licensed blind vendor on the fairgrounds for approximately the last 4 years. The vending is minimal there, projecting about 15,000 in gross sales a year. Now, I don't know that the profit off of $15,000, which is projected to be $3,000 a year, is going to be a significant assistance to the fair board. However, I can tell you that person struggles with her employment, and $200 a month goes a long way to helping that person pay their bills and put bread on the table. And I just ask you to please take into consideration not to erode the preference, but to encourage and help promote opportunities for persons who are blind here in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen. That's all I had signed up. Mike, you want to address the concerns at all?
Okay.
Well, being at a little bit of a disadvantage, I was not here for last year's fair, and nor for the formation of the council. I began December 1st. I'm not aware of what these gentlemen are speaking of in terms of being asked to leave the fair last year, so I can't address that. I can address the fact that we've not had any contact, to my knowledge, from them to ask for the opportunity to discuss what their future is with the state fair. As Senator Roblin and Gene Durfler mentioned, we're happy to look for opportunities for them to participate with us, provided it doesn't erode our core business and our core revenue stream. What I'm hearing from them lines up with that, but I'm not aware of them being thrown out of the fair or asked to leave the fair, nor any attempt to engage us in conversation in terms of what their relationship with the fair would be going forward. We're open to that within some limits.
They told us they were going to come to us and talk to us. That's what they said. We were waiting for that. Instead, we got this.
Hold on, please.
I'm sorry.
I'm not aware of any promise to do such, and we would have welcomed a conversation had they approached us.
Would you like an opportunity to take a break and talk to them?
Sure.
And maybe bring us back next week?
Sure.
Let's do that. Is there anybody else who wants to address this? All righty, so we will reschedule this bill for next week then. So we will recess on 9:34, and we're now up to 298. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 298.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 298 requires regulation of bodywork in the same manner that law currently regulates massage, defines bodywork, changes name of State Board of Massage Therapists to State Board of Massage Therapists and Bodyworkers, excludes community colleges and accredited colleges and universities from definition of massage facility, increases number of class hours required for licensure as massage therapist or bodyworker, authorizes board to require licensed massage therapists and licensed bodyworkers to acquire a renew endorsement before practicing advanced technique of massage or bodywork, becomes operative January 1st, 2016, declares an emergency effective upon passage. We do have a -3 amendment. It removes all reference to body work and body worker, eliminates name change of board, removes all reference to an endorsement, modifies the certified hours from 700 to 625, changes the verbiage to the definition of massage to, quote, massage does not mean the practicing of any form of high-velocity, short-amplitude, manipulative thrusting procedures provided to the articulations of the spine or extremities, close quote. We have no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Okay, are you Kathy?
I am.
Please.
Chair Byers and members of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation, for the record, I am Kathy Calise, board member and past chair of the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists. I am here today to express support for Senate Bill 298-3. Senate Bill 298-3 is the culmination of a national task force of the Federation of State Massage Therapy Boards. This task force met from 2012 to 2014. The goal of this task force was to define knowledge and skills components of entry-level education and recommend a minimum number of hours needed to prepare massage school graduates for safe and competent practice of the massage in the massage profession. The results of the two-year work by the task force was the CORE Entry-Level Analysis Project Report, or ELAP, which provides guidance to state massage therapy boards in an effort to offer a national standard for training of massage therapists and portability of massage licenses. Oregon Board of Massage Therapists currently requires 500 hours of certified class hours, and this bill would increase the hours to 625. Currently, most all of the 15 Oregon massage school programs exceed the 500 hours, and only three schools would need to increase their curriculum hours. The second component would statutorily exempt the student clinics at colleges and universities from obtaining a facility permit. This was an oversight from last session when the massage facility permit bill was passed and we only exempted private career schools. I encourage your support and passage of Senate Bill 298-3, and I'm open to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. My understanding was there was a, the dash threes represented an agreement between parties who were previously opposed.
That's correct.
Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
And Jeremy Hillegard? Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify on behalf of the Oregon Physical Therapy Association today. I am testifying, as I said, on behalf of the OPTA, who represents over 3,100 physical therapists and physical therapist assistants in the state of Oregon. I'm a licensed physical therapist and have been practicing for the past 7 years. I'm also an instructor and practicing clinician at Pacific University School of Physical Therapy. The OPTA does support Senate Bill 298-3, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, but being that we are in support of it.
No. Okay, I had you down as you marked you were against it.
As written, we are in support of the Dash 3 amendments.
Okay.
And if he did identify himself.
All right, any questions of...
He just needs to say his name for the record.
Oh, you didn't say... Oh, I'm sorry. Could you put your name in?
My apologies. Place? My name is Jeremy Hilliard.
Yeah. I thought you had, but apparently not. Any questions? No? Seeing none, thank you. That's all I have signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify on Senate Bill 298? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 298. Looks like we have a compromise that everybody agrees to. So the chair would move the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 298. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, is there any opposition to the motion? The Dash 3s are adopted. Chair moves Senate Bill 298 as amended by the Dash 3 amendments to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on that motion. Seeing none, is there any opposition to that motion? Senate Bill 298 is moved as amended by the Dash 3 is moved to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Carrier? Senator Riley, would you like to carry that?
Yes.
Senator Riley will carry. Close on that, and now we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 417. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 417 requires premise where a person makes retail sale of tobacco products and inhalant delivery systems to be licensed by the OLCC, requires retailers to have a physical address to avoid unregulated mobile sales, prohibits retailers from having the same address as a pharmacy to promote a culture that separates nicotine products from medications, prohibits retailers from being 1,000 feet from a school, requires imposition of fees on licensees that are reasonably calculated to pay for administering provisions of Act, prohibits certain types of retail sales of tobacco products and inhalant delivery systems, including the selling of products for free nominal fee or reduced price and the use of coupons for tobacco products and inhalant delivery systems, establishes Tobacco Control Fund and continuously appropriates money and fund to OLCC for the purpose of administering provisions of the Act, becomes operative January 1st, 2016, declares emergency effective on passage. We do have two amendments with this bill. The Dash 5 amendments require a licensor for inhalant delivery system retailers and exempts them from the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act for the purpose of sampling, allows state police, sheriffs, and other police officers to assist the OLCC in the enforcement of the provisions of the Act, requires the OLCC to enter an agreement with the Oregon Health Authority for administration and enforcement of cigar bars and smoke shops, changes operative date from January 1st, 2016 to July 1st, 2017 to allow OLCC time for implementation, requires OLCC to make reports regarding to the preparation of the OLCC for the duties, functions, and powers provided by this Act in order to better enable the Commission to exercise those duties. We also have the Dash 6 amendments, which clarifies the interim between the law passing and the implementation that a sampling would only be allowed if the business holds themselves out to be primarily selling inhalant delivery systems and also does not sell alcohol or tobacco. It eliminates requirement for police officers to immediately notify district attorney of county for OLCC violation of this Act, removes provision for businesses selling inhalant delivery systems do not permit persons under 18. We do not have a fiscal or revenue statement with either of those amendments, nor the introduced measure.
And we have a related measure that I think I'll open that one as well. Senate Bill 733 will open on that as well. James, you want to do that
sure.
one real quick?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 733 modifies name of Oregon Liquor Control Commission to Adult Substances Control Commission, changes name of Oregon Liquor Control Commission account to Oregon Liquor Control account. There are no amendments, and we do have a minimal revenue impact, and we have a fiscal impact with Senate Bill 733.
Okay, and Senator Steiner Hayward and Representative Taylor and Senator Mona Sanderson. You know how to draw a crowd.
I do indeed. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senator from Senate District 17, Northwest Portland and Beaverton, also a family physician. I appreciate the committee hearing this bill today. This bill has two important purposes. First and foremost is tobacco control. We know that the longer people wait before they try tobacco for the first time, the less likely they are to become addicted. Currently, the legal age for tobacco in this state is 18. Even that probably isn't quite low enough, but that's not really the point at the moment. The bigger issue is, how do people get a hold of tobacco products? Oregon is one of only 8 states in the union that does not require licensure for tobacco retailers. We require licensure to sell alcohol. We will be requiring licensure to sell marijuana, but we do not require licensure to sell tobacco, which is arguably, and I think supported by the medical literature, more addictive than either alcohol or marijuana, and ultimately causes far more deaths and morbidity associated with it than either alcohol or marijuana. Tobacco is a dangerous drug. Do I think it should be illegal? No. But I do think it should be controlled better. The problem right now is we really don't have any way to do adequate enforcement, and there's no adequate incentive for retailers to follow the rules about sales to minors. The state police are charged with enforcing this currently. They support the law, obviously, but they have a limited budget, which they quite rightly use to focus more on serious crime. And when, in fact, a retailer is found to have violated the prohibitions against sales to minors, all they face is a fine. They don't face what retailers who sell alcohol to minors face, which is a temporary or permanent revocation of their license, which is a serious incentive toward following the law and not selling to minors. The more we can keep tobacco out of the hands of minors, the better. As you have heard from Mr. Labar, there are also other provisions about who can get a license to sell tobacco. We think it's sort of ironic to sell tobacco in places that are pharmacies, so this bill would prohibit licenses going to places that have the same physical address as a pharmacy. There are other provisions in it that have been proven to reduce use by minors, including no mobile sales, no discounts or coupons, no sales within 1,000 feet of schools, although there is a grandfather clause for businesses that are already established prior to the time of the effective date of this bill. All of these things have been shown to decrease sales to minors and decrease the likelihood that young people will take up the habit of using tobacco and ultimately suffer the adverse consequences of addiction and nicotine. There's a second piece of this bill that has generated perhaps even a little bit more controversy, and that is the issue around inhalant delivery systems. I also have the privilege of serving under Chair Mona Sanderson on the Senate Health Care Policy Committee. There we heard recently the testimony on House Bill 2546, and I'm sure you'll hear more about that from the House Chief Sponsor of that bill, Representative Taylor, to add inhaled delivery systems to the provisions of the Oregon Indoor Clean Air Act and prohibit their sale to minors, those being defined as those under 18 as well. You may well ask why I am willing to add this back in and to allow sampling of flavors, as it were, of inhaled delivery systems in the shops that only sell these, for two reasons. The first and foremost is that we heard very compelling testimony at that hearing about the fact that adults can be very reluctant when they're trying to quit smoking to switch to an inhalant delivery system, and they want to be able to try the different flavors while they're in the store. I think that's a reasonable thing to do because these things are not cheap, and I think that it turns out, surprisingly to me, a lot of adults like flavors that I would have normally not expected them to like. Not a judgment statement, just a surprise. But also, and we also heard compelling testimony that a lot of people are using these to cut back on smoking and slowly reducing the amount of nicotine in the solutions that they use in their inhalant delivery systems. And I think this is an important public health benefit. Do I think inhalant delivery systems are safe? No, I don't. And that's why I think they need to be prohibited in their sale to minors, and that's why I think they need to be included overall in the Indoor Clean Air Act. But do I think that given what the provisions would be that would allow them to be exempt from this, only people over 18 would be allowed in the store. More than 75% of their revenues would have to come from the inhalant delivery systems, and a range of other prohibitions would limit the access to these? Yes, I do, and I think that that's a pretty compelling reason. There's also a business case. This is a growing small business in our state, and I think that encouraging small business in our state is a good thing. And finally, I think that having them licensed, because they will be selling nicotine-containing products, is in the compelling interest of the state as well. Nicotine is addictive no matter how you get it. And if we do not license the retailers of inhaled delivery systems, then we will not know who's selling them, and people can get them there, and we will be in the same position with them that we are now currently with tobacco retailers. So if we're going to license tobacco retailers, which I certainly hope this committee will support, I think we have a compelling interest to also license retailers of inhalant delivery systems, and I think it's a reasonable trade-off to allow them to have sampling of their products on premises with these very limiting restrictions about who can enter the stores and what they can sell. I'm sure that you'll hear different testimony about this issue, and I'm grateful to the committee for considering all sides of this as you listen to this testimony. I'll be happy to take questions either now or after you've heard from my colleagues.
Thank you, Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Senator Lori Moniz Anderson. I represent Gresham Troutdale-Wood Village, Fairview, and parts of East Portland. I am very much in favor of licensure of vape shops, and particularly for the reasons that we need adequate enforcement, and we can't really have adequate enforcement unless there is adequate licensure. I'm not going to repeat what she said. Regarding the sampling piece, I'm not in love with allowing vape shops to have sampling, but if it is a business, one vape shop has 130 employees, and I would like this bill to pass, and so that is why I am in favor of opening this up to flavoring in vape shops. I mean sampling of so that is why I'm in favor of this. There are some pieces of the legislation that in the amendment that maybe not might need to be tweaked, but we need to hear the testimony first. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Representative.
Thank you, Senator. Welcome. Hi, I'm Kathleen Taylor. For the record, State Representative from House District 41, Southeast Portland, Milwaukee, and Oak Grove. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today about the licensure for retailers of tobacco and e-cigarette products. I thank Steiner Hayward for bringing this important issue forward. Licensing retailers would be a strong tool to ensure compliance with our public health laws regarding sales of tobacco products to minors. It gives teeth to the rules. Currently, when a retailer breaks the law and allows sales of these products to minors, it is the clerk of the store who bears responsibility. There is no sanction against the managers or owners who allow it to happen. Oregon has one of the highest, if not the highest, rate of illegal sales of tobacco products to minors, threatening federal dollars for tobacco prevention programs. Requiring a license to sell tobacco and giving additional authority to OLCC to enforce and revoke that license would put compliance at a much higher priority. I do have a couple of concerns to share with you, however. Nicotine addiction and smoking pose a well-documented health risk. I understand Senator Steiner Hayward's unease that pharmacies will sell medications to treat COPD, asthma, and other respiratory illness on one hand, are also selling cigarettes and tobacco products that contribute to disease. Big chain stores like Safeway and Target have pharmacy departments down one aisle and while selling tobacco products in another part of the store. This version of the licensure bill will prohibit the big box retailers that have co-located pharmacies from selling tobacco. So, for example, Target, you know, Walmart, stores like that would not, because they have a pharmacy within their store, they would not be able to sell tobacco products. And that's the area where I think this is a policy decision that needs to be thoroughly vetted on its own right, and I'm concerned that that's a little bit buried in this bill. I do support that there should be licensure, thinking more about the areas that are the smaller shops, and that's a little bit different than lumping them all together for everyone who sells cigarettes, and I think that we should spend the time to kind of go through all of those details. During the interim, Senator Steiner Hayward and I and Senator Mona Sanderson also attended some of these work groups, and I worked on a large work group, about 35 stakeholders, including medical personnel, local governments, law enforcement, and others, to craft legislation dealing with e-cigarettes, the inhalant delivery systems. At those meetings, many regulations regarding tobacco and e-cigarettes were discussed. At those meetings, many regulations regarding tobacco, licensure was discussed. New taxes were brought up, prohibiting flavoring and banning internet sales. All of those topics came up. The consensus of the group was that prohibiting the sale of e-cigarettes to minors and protecting Oregon's Indoor Air Act was the highest priority. Let me say that again. Prohibiting the sale of e-cigarettes to minors and including e-cigarettes in the Indoor Clean Air Act with no special carve-outs was the top priority of that work group. We have had testimony over on the House side, this bill, House Bill 2546, which I jokingly call the mothership bill, passed out of the House overwhelmingly on a 56-2 vote. Okay, so advocates have worked very hard, and this includes law enforcement, the counties, Association of Cities, all of that, to pass House Bill 2546 without any carve-outs. The Dash 6 amendment before you includes a vape shop exemption to the Indoor Clean Air Act. There was no consultation, to my knowledge, with the stakeholders group in drafting this language. They were left out of the process overall. There may have been a few individuals included, but the whole process we did not was not the group that participated. This provision in the amendment to SB Senate Bill 417 undermines those efforts. For those two concerns, inadequate discussion of the big box retailer licensure, and for the special carve-outs in the Indoor Clean Air Act, SB 417 is not yet ready to move forward. I urge you to hold on to SB 417 until these issues can be resolved. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
There you go.
Senator Girard?
Yeah, it's been brought up over and over again that we have one of the highest rates of selling to minors of tobacco products. Yet I must inform you the analysis by the Federal Drug Administration, which they checked over 1,000 vendors in the state of Oregon, rated us as being better than 94% in compliance compared to Delaware, which was 83% out of compliance, and Ohio that was 80% out of compliance. We have one of the lowest rates. And so I'm trying to find the need for this bill and the huge cost that it's going to incur. I agree selling stuff to minors is a major problem, but I also think that, I don't have a problem with bringing vaping into the standard of not selling it to minors, but trying to move this into the OLCC when the FDA, if they did 1,000 checks in 2015, there's only 6,000 vendors. That's one out of six. That's pretty good oversight.
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, if I may, I'll start, and if my colleagues have anything to add, they can chime in. One of the biggest challenges without licensure, Senator, is that we don't actually know who's selling tobacco. As long as wholesale taxes are paid, anybody can retail cigarettes, and that means you can sell them out of the back of a truck. And so those people are not people that sting operations or surveys can actually identify. And that's one of the reasons that we have these high rates of sales. We also don't have really significant ways to identify who those people are. Finally, we do a version of surveys that look at teen behaviors. in Oregon, you know, in the states, and Oregon has one of the highest rates of smoking for minors. And I'd be happy to provide those data for the committee if you so desire. So they're getting them somewhere, Senator, and one of the ways they're getting them is because there's no really good way to figure out who's actually selling them. So they may have done surveys, but we don't actually know who those 6,000 retailers really are. We only know the big box stores. We don't know all the mom-and-pop ones, and we can't get those data from the Department of Revenue because it's illegal.
Further questions? Senator Monroe?
Well, one of the reasons that Oregon's rate of smoking appears to be high because our taxes are more than a dollar a pack less than in Washington, and a lot of the good folks from Washington come across and buy their cigarettes in Oregon. The solution to that, of course, would be to raise Oregon's tobacco taxes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think we can all agree that Oregon's tobacco taxes are low. I'm a senator, and that's the purview of the House to choose to raise taxes. I also will say publicly that I find tobacco taxes somewhat problematic. There's no question that tobacco use is price sensitive, and the more we raise prices, the fewer people smoke. On the other hand, we become dependent on revenue, and I find that a really tough position for the state to be in. I'm not necessarily objecting to tobacco taxes. If one makes it to our side of the building, I would certainly give serious consideration to voting for it. But I think we have to take all available steps, and licensure is a step that's been proven to reduce use by minors in general.
Senator Trump?
Yeah, just to follow up on some of the other things that I was saying. Under the Federal Drug Administration, if you're in violation, the fines run from $250 to $11,000. So, I mean, these are pretty hefty fines. And so I'm really struggling with the idea that there are a lot of vendors out there that are breaking the law when such fines are very easily implemented.
Senator, my 16-year-old daughter, who looks like she's 20, walked in and bought cigarettes because I asked her to go do it at a local Plaid pantry. And I'm not dismissing any of the points that you're making, but I am saying that it happens all the time. And I'm sorry, but most of the time, that enforcement just doesn't happen.
But your daughter may be able to be served liquor as well. I mean, it's there.
Yes, and if she is and the OLCC knows about it, then they will lose their license. But that doesn't happen, and it's not
necessarily true either. Usually,
well, they'll have a suspension. We can continue to debate this, but I don't think it's necessarily a great public use. It's up to the chair, of course.
Other questions?
And Senator Beyer, I am inclined to I would like to testify on the other bill. If you'd like me to do that now, we can do that,
I'm
or
sorry.
You can hear the rather.
Please.
It's up to you, since you opened both simultaneously, and my colleagues can choose to stay or not. The other bill that we're considering, and I'm terrible with bill numbers even when they're on my own bills, is the rename for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. OLCC is a great name when they're only controlling liquor. We know that they will begin to have purview over marijuana in the near future, and should Senate Bill 417 pass to have retail licensure, they will then be controlling tobacco as well, the sales of tobacco as well. And so after some conversations with colleagues and also with Mr. Marks from OLCC, it became clear that it would be a reasonable thing to consider to rename the agency. There are also provisions in this bill that direct what would be ASCC to standardize regulations as much as possible among the various substances that they control, so that if there are businesses that sell more than one of these, for example, it's very common for liquor stores to sell cigarettes or for bars to sell cigarettes or for Plaid pantries or 7-Elevens to sell both beer and cigarettes, that they would be able to stack licenses, thereby reducing the expense and the paperwork associated with obtaining these licenses. And there are some other provisions for this. It's a pretty simple thing, but the idea is that the name of our agencies ought to reflect what they do. And should we ever decide to legalize anything else in this state that's currently not legal and have that agency regulate it, we wouldn't have to change their name again. From a semantics perspective, I also think it's important that the name reflect that we think these are things that adults should use and not anybody, not children, not minors. And so adult substances struck me as a reasonable thing to do, and the agency was fine with it.
Okay. Thank you again. Questions? Okay.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you. Kelly Lovelace. It's our policy that we give people a chance who are at least 100 miles from the Capitol, first shot at testifying. I have one. Mr. Lovelace, if you'd like to testify. And after that, I think we've got a number of people on both sides of the bill. We'll just kind of alternate back and forth. Welcome. If you can give put your name on the record, we'd appreciate it.
Okay. My name is Kelly Lovelace, and Chairman Beyer and committee, I'm glad to be here. I'm an investor in a vaping store, and I must tell you that the reason I was is it's an avenue to quit smoking. And I talked with my doctor about this, and he said, if you're vaping, we'll take you off the smoker's list at the doctor's office. In other words, for insurance purposes and those type of things, my doctor at least will say I'm a non-smoker. Although it is the same doctor that gave me a form of rat poison after my heart attack, so you might take that into consideration too. But I think one of my main thoughts here is vaping or this type of activity is not a tobacco product. And I really believe that you need to look at that in a fairly serious way. It is nicotine, but most of the material, as I understand it, in vaping is the same stuff you might have in a nebulizer that you would give to your child if he had an asthma attack. So there's, you know, calling this a tobacco product, I think, is an unfair way to look at it. I do, however, think that some regulations are in order. I think more so in how products are put together. I look at our shop as a place where we're doing business where we need to be clean, need to have stainless steel tables. It needs to be a sanitary operation, I guess is what I would say. And so those are things that I think maybe ought to be looked at. But I'm not sure calling this a tobacco product is really fair and truthful. And I do think that there are a tremendous amount of people who are getting away from cigarettes and are finding a way to be better, to live better because of it. And I really looked into it. I stuck quite a bit of money into this, and I didn't want to walk down a road that put me in a bad place. And so I don't look at it as a tobacco deal, and I really think it's something that should be considered pretty hard before you put it in that category. And that's really kind of what I have to say, and I appreciate your time very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly. Question?
Do you have a question or two? I'd be glad to answer.
Don't see any. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Let me take them.
Go ahead.
First of all, we have a limited amount of time. We have a lot of people to go through, so we're going to bring you up in threes. Carrie Nyssen, Sarah Higginbottom, Mel Radar. And if you could limit your testimony to a minute or two, that'd be great.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and committee members. My name is Carrie Nyssen, and I serve as the Vice President for Advocacy of the American Lung Association in Oregon, and I'm here today to urge your support of 417. For us, it's all about our kids and putting evidence-based policies in place to discourage the use of tobacco products so they can lead a lifetime free of addiction and free of premature death. 3,300 youth become daily smokers each year in Oregon, and we should do more to prevent our youth from using tobacco. And it takes a comprehensive approach to do this, and retail licensing is one of those policies. We're very supportive of some of the parameters in the bill. We love the no coupon redemption. We love the no sale in pharmacies, and we love not having shops within 1,000 feet of schools. In closing, again, I just think it's all about our kids, and comprehensive tobacco retail licensure will reduce the number of kids that ever start smoking, and we think that's a real win for Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Beyer, committee members, Sarah Higginbotham, American Heart Association, here representing the American Heart Association and the American Stroke Association. We support Senate Bill 417. As you've already heard, Oregon lags behind the rest of the country when it comes to illegal sales of tobacco to minors. Oregon has far outpaced any other state, and in 2013, we had the highest rate in the country at 22.5%. Which was more than double the national rate, which is about 9%. To put that in perspective, one in six Oregon kids are successful in purchasing tobacco. If you have a classroom of 30 students, that's 5 students. If you have a school of 500, that's 80 students who are walking away with a pack of cigarettes or cigars. We also support all, my last note would just be to say that we're in strong support of the ban on sales in pharmacies. You might know that in February of 2014, CVS voluntarily took tobacco out of their drug stores, and we applaud them putting public health before their profits. And in 2010, the American Pharmacists Association urged pharmacies to stop selling and pushed state pharmacy boards to stop issuing licenses and renewing licenses of pharmacies selling those products. Thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Mel Rader. I'm the Executive Director of Upstream Public Health. We very much support Senate Bill 417. Because of the issue of sales to minors, I also included in the testimony that was just distributed some pictures of retailers where they were not following state and federal laws, which we found in an assessment around Multnomah County. I'm not going to go into the detail why I support the measure, but I want to address the Dash 6 amendments and want to say that I oppose the Dash 6 amendments for a few reasons. One of them is that if we treat e-cigarettes like other tobacco and nicotine products, we would not allow sampling. And we cannot. You cannot sample cigarettes before you buy it. You cannot sample any smoking products before you buy them. And that's because we want to create a threshold to buying something for any addictive products. Sampling of addictive products are simply not the same as sampling of non-addictive products. So I want to make that clear. In addition, the Dash 6 amendment would have a significant additional cost. It does refer to the percentage of sales related to e-cigarettes. That requires a financial audit. When we looked at the hookah lounges and cigar shops, that it amounted to about $5,000 per establishment in order to look at the certification and auditing. And I would say, as I look at the Dash 6 amendments, the licensing fees get spread across all the retailers. And so those retailers that have that additional privilege of providing sampling do not pay the additional cost associated with that. I would also ask you to look at other provisions related to the other exemptions if you are going to go with a Dash 6 amendment, and that would be stopping the spread of additional stores, looking at a set amount of seats within the establishment. So these are some of the things that need to be looked at. And the bill as a whole, I'd also like to look at a few additional things of a component around education and training. We know from programs around the country that it works best when we have education, we have training around tobacco regulations and how to sell cessation devices. And that's an important part of any licensing program. And then I would finally say that the county health departments should have a clear and important role in enforcement because they know the stores a lot of the times that the state agencies don't have, and they're involved in education at the local level, and ask you to give leeways for them to be engaged in both the education side and along with the state agency in the enforcement side. Thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you. Any questions? We have a lot to go through here. So Colin Rao, Taylor Jones, and James Wright.
We have a my name is Colin Rao with Emerald Vapors in Eugene, Oregon. Thank you for your time. I have a quick slideshow I'd like to show.
It's got to be quick.
I'll go through it as quickly as I can, yes.
Well, you get 2 minutes. We're due to quit here in about 6 minutes, so...
Okay, I'm going to jump to the
We're
going to
stay over, but we have to be kind of efficient here, because I might be the only one staying.
I represent Northwest Vapor Association.
Okay.
We're an association of vape shops in Oregon and manufacturers. I'm going to go over why we oppose this bill. E-cigarettes, vaping products, are not tobacco products and should not be treated the same as tobacco products. SB 417 prevents us from using coupons and incentive programs to help smokers quit smoking. Between this bill and House Bill 2546, e-cigarette vaping businesses are under the authority of two different regulating bodies, OLCC and OHA. Industry events are an important part of the e-cigarette vaping industry, and this bill would outlaw them. The grandfather provision of this bill is too easily rescinded at the whim of the OLCC. The language in this bill is unnecessarily vague in too many places. The bill is not comprehensive enough and will require additional legislation to have the proper effect. The cost of the permit is undefined and can be established, changed at the whim of the OLCC. And there has been no consultation with true representative of the e-cigarette vaping industry in the crafting of this or other proposed bills. What we do approve of is that it attempts to eliminate or at least control the growing black market sales of potentially unsafe e-cigarette vaping products. The -5 amendment allows for an exclusion of vape shops in the Clean Air Act, and the -5 amendment, this bill wouldn't take until January, didn't take place until January 5th or 1st. And let me also just point out that our association strongly supports any age restriction that you would want to impose.
Okay.
We had much more than that, and I represent, many, many shops in Oregon. And so
we have written form.
Uh-huh.
Make sure that she gets the written form that gets on our computer. So we sit at home at night and we go through some of this.
I
hate to shut you off, but
as well.
Some of these other people, well, we're down to two now, and I might lose the other one. So it would be nice for the other people to be able to read it.
And I understand. And Northwest Vapor Association is a growing association that has a lot of back. So, our voices.
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, my name is James Wright. I am the lab manager for VapeRite, a family-owned store in Kaiser. One of the issues, my major issue is that I had that is, as far as I knew, there were two agencies that would be dealing with this, OLCC and the Oregon Health Authority, and I did not realize that also the state police would also be involved in this. So I'm kind of confused as to the effectiveness of being oversighted by three different departments, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So, according to the bill, I believe it is that the OLCC and the OHA can do inspections at any time. So that would be one shows up and then the other shows up and then everything else and then, and then the state police or whatever. So that's my big confusion. And my worry is that, they'll just keep coming in and doing whatever. And also my other thing about point I wanted to make was on the sampling in our shop, we have zero nicotine samplers. So when they do sample the products in our store, there is no nicotine in them. So they're basically sampling just the flavors themselves. I thank you for your time.
Okay.
And
go ahead.
I'll leave it.
My name is Taylor Jones. I'm the lab manager for Vape Game. We have three retail locations across the state, and we manufacture liquid that goes all over the country. We employ almost 50 people. So I got my degree in biology, emphasis in molecular biology, and from the University of Oregon about almost 2 years ago. I worked in a bacterial host interaction lab for the last year and a half of that, where I worked on human health concerns. When I got into the vaping industry, I was concerned that we were just setting up another tobacco product. When I did my research, because I am qualified to read scientific literature, I found that the stuff that's in cigarettes is not tobacco products. So there's pure nicotine, pharmaceutical grade, which doesn't bring along with it any of the nitrosamines and the other cancer-causing particles that come from combustion of a cigarette or from pure, real tobacco products. So what we're selling is not a tobacco product and shouldn't necessarily be deemed as such or regulated in the same way. But despite the fact that there is legislation coming through to restrict sales, we've been taking measures since we opened our shops to restrict sales to minors. We've actually fired one employee, not because he sold the vapor pens to a minor, but because he did not check the ID after being asked to check IDs after a couple times. So we do take this seriously, nicotine addiction, but to restrict something that can save so many lives in such a way as this just doesn't make sense. It would be looked back on as a harm to the community rather than a help.
Okay. Thank you so much, gentlemen. Since I'm the only one, there are no questions.
Thank you.
Okay, just for the record, if you're a lobbyist, I'm not going to hear your testimony. If you represent the OLCC or the Oregon Health Authority, I'm not going to hear your testimony. Okay, so that leaves Jay Douglas, Jen Baker, and let's bring those two up.
Vice Chair Gerard, I'm Jen Baker with the Oregon Nurses Association, a registered lobbyist, so I'll go ahead and submit written testimony.
Okay, thank you so much. All right.
Good afternoon, Senator. I'm hoping to hold my testimony for when the committee is
This going. Might be it.
This
so
might
you
be
need,
it.
If you have testimony, you need to give written testimony, or you can give verbal testimony, which goes on tapes.
Okay. I think I'll go ahead then.
Okay.
Good afternoon. My name is Jay Douglas. I'm the Environmental Health Director for Multnomah County Health Department, here to speak in support of Senate Bill 417, although we do stand in opposition to the dash to any amendment that exempts vape shops from the Indoor Clean Air Act. The Multnomah County Board of County Commissioners has taken a leadership role, acting on behalf of the citizens of Multnomah County to undertake an extensive review of the impact of illegal sales to youth in our county and the problem of youth access to e-cigarettes. Multnomah County has a particular problem with youth access to tobacco. We have the dubious distinction of having the highest rate of illegal sales to youth of any county in the nation. We know this from the SINAR data. And we also, as we're looking at the youth access to e-cigarettes, we see that in Multnomah County, as well as the rest of the country, e-cigarette use among youth has tripled from 2011 to 2013. Our Board of County Commissioners recently acted to pass a local ordinance restricting the use of inhalant delivery products where tobacco was prohibited, and has banned sales to youth younger than 18. This county is also monitoring this session's work on tobacco retail licensing, because we know that tobacco retail licensing is a key strategy for reducing access to youth sales. And our Board of County Commissioners is prepared to act if the state does not. We prefer the state to act, but we'd like to make sure that we have the prerogative to continue that effort or to enact tobacco retail licensing at the county level. We stand today as a strong partner in reducing youth access to tobacco, and I would be happy to take any questions if you'd like.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. We have a group of three coming up: Dave Glenn, Joseph Gilpatrick, and Matt Minahan.
Matt Minahan's our lobbyist, and he won't be speaking.
Oh, okay.
My name is David Glenn. I am a business owner. We have stores in Alaska, Washington, California, and one in Gresham, Oregon. We're looking at trying to open up more stores, six in Oregon as it is, and right now we're concerned about this. Northwest Vaping Association has an amendment that they're putting forward on this one. We don't agree with the Dash 6 on this one. That amendment's not quite ready. It would remove vaping altogether from the 417, but still exempt vape shops from the Clean Air Act. And I want to kind of expound on that one. There's a lack of understanding, I think, from a lot of places, including the Multnomah County Health Department, when we tried to work with them up there. Vape shops, the model of the business, requires sampling in there to help the customers actually understand what nicotine level they need, because not everybody's the same. Flavors are really not just kind of a whim. They actually need the flavoring to kind of get them away from the tobacco itself. Vape shops specifically, any store that's dealing with 75% or more of its revenue dealing with vapor products specifically, are in the market to help people get off of cigarettes specifically. We also self-regulate. The stores might specifically, we don't sell to minors as it is. We card. And if an employee fails to card somebody, they lose their job for it. So this is kind of putting regulations in place that aren't really necessary on the vaping industry, and I think it's going to impact us negatively. Another aspect of this Dash 6 that really concerns me is the discounting. I understand how that applies on tobacco packs of cigarettes. Don't discount cigarettes. They have to sell at a fixed price. That shows by just arbitrarily throwing all the vapor products into that same category, there's no understanding in there of what vapor products really are. You're talking about hundreds of thousands of different products that are constantly being renewed through China and stuff like that. If it's just vapor solutions, there's a market life to them. And these small vendor shops that are putting their own money in to get these things set up are going to be stuck on inventory. A lot of times the only way to move the inventory out is put it on sale because it becomes irrelevant. Unlike a pack of Camels that holds its relevancy for 60 years, a bottle of juice does not hold its relevancy for more than 3 months at best, six. So that needs to kind of be taken out of there. The other concern is, of course, lumping us in with big tobacco. We're not big tobacco. We're not even a tobacco product. I think that kind of settles. We don't like the idea of, and that's the other concern, licensing expense. It's not listed in there. Before I go and open up six more stores in Oregon, I'm a little concerned on what kind of licensing expenditures, and if it's going to be too expensive and they're not going to take in consideration these are small businesses, I'm not bringing my business to Oregon. And that's all. Thank you.
Is there a Ron Sather? I think he's the last of the public here.
Thank you for your time. My name is Joseph Gilpatrick. I am the owner of Northwest Freedom Vape, Lebanon, Oregon. I just wanted to touch base on a couple of things. A lot of people, obviously, we don't want tobacco in the hands of children. I'm 36 years old. I graduated in 1997. The statistics show that 37% of high school kids back then smoked cigarettes. Today, national average is 9%. It's on a big decline. It's not just because of taxation. It's because of alternative products, smoke cessation. As we know, tobacco is highly addictive, almost as much so as heroin. When a heroin addict goes to stop using heroin, they use methadone, which is a cleaner form of that drug, to help them wean themselves off of it. Nicotine, of course, is a stimulant, but it doesn't contain the carcinogens, it doesn't contain the tar, and it's a much healthier, safer alternative for somebody that has been addicted to these products for 20 to 30 years, and it's a way to wean yourself off, and it is not a tobacco product. It is a vital tool for our community to use these products to get off of tobacco. One other nice fact is one out of every 300 people that use vaporizer products didn't smoke. So we're not marketing to people to try to get them to use vape if they don't smoke. The first question in our store is how much do you smoke? And we talk to them. If someone doesn't smoke, I'm trying to sell a product, but right off the bat, I tell them they don't need this. This is not for them. These are tools to help you quit smoking. We don't advertise outside. There's not big billboards. Those coupons are for adults inside an adult atmosphere to get a discount on their products. And it's a store incentive. It's not something that we're trying to market for children. An inhalant delivery system was another issue on this. I don't see a cup being an alcohol delivery system. I don't see a straw being a cocaine delivery system. These are products that are being misused. So a vaporizer, which is made to help you quit smoking cigarettes, if you put the wrong substance in it and you're using it incorrectly, it doesn't make it an a cannabinoid delivery system. It shouldn't be under these same guidelines. It's a product that's being misused. Liquid nicotine is in gum, patches. It's in all kinds of different products to help people quit smoking. This is just another way that I choose to ingest it, and I don't feel that it should be taxed, and it should definitely be regulated and keep out of children's hands, but not under these authorities. And there's just too many gray areas in these bills that we need to touch base, get more education from people in the vaping industry, and we can reform this and maybe get it done by 2016 instead of 2017 and do it correctly. And that's all I have for you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ron, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Ron Sather. Excuse me?
I said lead us home.
Oh. Yeah, my name is Ron Sather. I'm a voter out of Senate District 8 in Albany there. I'm a owner of a vape shop and a board member of Northwest Vapor Association as well. I found it interesting that Representative Taylor, when she was going through that list of stakeholders, did not list vape shop owners or anybody with the vape shop interest, because we did not have any say whatsoever in any of these talks that they've been going over. She was talking about all these different stakeholders that they had. I find that very interesting. While I applaud the efforts that they are and agree with the need for some regulation here, and a lot of the issues that they're trying to deal with, I'm against the way it as it is written currently. I would like to see it regulated, but I want to see some reasonable regulation that isn't unjustly put on us. I believe the language in this bill is a little bit vague. It needs to be more definitive. It could easily cause some confusion. I don't like the dual regulating agencies portion of it. I believe that just leaves confuses the issues of interpreting that even further. I believe NUVA, Northwest Vapor Association, has insights into the industry that could definitely help accomplish the intent of this bill if we were just allowed to be brought to the table, and we'd be more than willing, happy to discuss this and try to get this bill rewritten. This bill does not go into effect as it was set, or as amended, until 2017. I really honestly believe that if they would be willing to invite us to the table, we could go over this and get some of this accomplished in time for the special session next year and still be implemented by that time. We are also currently already in talks with the Department of Justice, and we've been in contact with the Department of Revenue as well. So I see that there's parallels going on in different agencies here, and I think this is going to create a major patchwork if we go through with this right now of interagencies that really don't have a clue what's going on. They're trying to do parallel items.
Okay. Any questions? Mm-hmm. We're through if you want to, unless you want.
We're done?
We're done. We didn't do any of the lobby.
This one worked.
Yeah, we're going to
move. We got a loose one.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if you didn't get a talk today, we will reschedule this one. And if that isn't possible, if you want to send us an email to the committee account, we'll take that. Everybody will get that, and we'll take that in consideration. I apologize. We're actually about almost a half an hour over our allotted time. So this room is scheduled for another meeting. We're going to have to leave it out. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearings on these two bills, and we will adjourn for the
day. Thank you.
Thank you. Bills, and we will adjourn for the
Thank
day.
You. Thank you.